operations type revenues.
Okay.
You know, for example, the timber harvest off the Elliott State Forest is by far the largest amount of revenue that comes in.
Okay.
So you'd be reducing it down to a relatively small portion of income. Secondly, on the Dash 3 amendment, some concerns there are that it does call for it to be repaid. However, it doesn't ask that it be repaid with interest, and thus the Common School Fund would be losing that portion of interest during that time. There's also a question of what happens during those biennia when you've made, say, a withdrawal from the Common School Fund, and then are there distributions during those interim biennia, or do you just lose the distributions that the state or that the schools might already get? I think also, as I mentioned, that would affect investment strategy that the state would have currently in the Common School Fund, as well as it, by reducing the amount of revenue that it could generate in that investment, it would impact future generations. So I think there, and I maybe can turn it over to Kevin to talk about some of the legal issues connected with that.
Let's stop and maybe have some discussion on some of the policy questions you've raised. First, questions from the committee, Representative Carlson.
Thank you. A question that was raised earlier, and I don't know if you have the answer, if someone else will have the answer. With the Dash 2 amendments, it actually takes out that piece of the land grants or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's $800 million total in there, what portion is taken out when you take that out? Do you have any sense of that? How much is left over, I guess, would be my question.
I'm not sure. The fund itself goes back 140 years back, a little over 140 years back to statehood. We have real good records for about the last 20 years, and things start getting more and more murky or difficult to figure out exactly how much is statutory and how much is revenue. We're trying to look back into the records now to see how far back we can go. So it would be trying to figure that out would be the tough part.
You don't have a ballpark?
Yeah. I think, you know, if you looked at the ratio of, you know, that statutory revenues are probably about, I don't know, I give a real ballpark of 5 or 10% of the Common School Fund.
So 90 to 95% would be omitted from it by the Dash 2 amendments? Is that what you're saying?
They could be. Now, the one real big question that I don't know yet, because some of these legal issues aren't answered yet, is in terms of the investment income, which makes up right now the overwhelming amount of income. And that is, once that investment income is generated within the Common School Fund, is it then all part of the Common School Fund and becomes part of that trust or not? That remains to be seen to be worked out.
Okay. One more question, Mr. Chair. The example that you gave about the early 80s, if the Common School Fund had been used, if then that money had been paid back in the successive, was it three biennium in the Dash 3 amendments, then certainly it would have been able to take advantage in the 90s when the boom hit. Wouldn't that be true with the Dash 3 amendments?
Chair Shirley, Representative Carlson, yes, that would be true. However, you still would have lost the interest in any kind of earnings you would have had for that six-year period. And if you would have had a time period where, say, you borrowed it and then you missed out on a real upturn in the stock market following a recession, then you would miss those type of earnings.
One more thought, Mr. Chair. But isn't it true that if the conditions are set that they are right now to trigger it, where it has to be a downturn in successive quarters, that the chances of making big earnings on anything would probably be slowing down during that time period?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Carson, not necessarily, because often, you know, the stock market will rebound then once as you're coming out of the recession, as investors see that the prospects of profits are becoming greater, and so you know you may or you may not. It's trying to look into the crystal ball of trying to forecast what the stock market might do is really difficult. I spent 4 years.
And it's a job of Treasury, isn't it?
It's a job of Treasury. Yeah, I spent 4 years as state economist trying to predict the economy, but I never tried doing that with the stock market.
Well, but isn't that part of the trade-off, though, that you're sure you're foregoing some of the earnings over time on the money that you've taken out, but the trade-off being that you are also using these funds to keep schools open and operating during downturn? I mean, I think that's a reasonable trade-off. I guess it's like using money out of the savings account to keep the family fed and not saying, no, I'm saving that for your college. And the kids are hungry and take the money out and you're going to feed them now, understanding there may be less money when they get to college, but you hope that, you know, things will turn around. You anticipate that things being cyclical or cyclical, that they will turn around and you'll replace that money. So to me, that's part of the trade-off. And I guess on that score, I'll leave because I have to run upstairs to the Judiciary Committee for in just a minute. So let me jump to the front and make my one comment. Your testimony refers to the policy of whether we should benefit today's kids at the expense of future kids. And again, looking at this as an opportunity for using this as a way of keeping schools open and functioning during down times and serious recessions, can't you just reverse that and say that this gives us the why should we benefit future kids at the expense of today's kids? It goes back to that issue, if you can't feed the kids, don't you take the money out of savings and a college account and feed them, and then you'll catch up later when they get to college. It seems to me you can use that policy argument both ways.
Yeah. And Representative Shirley, I think that that's one of the things that's a real delicate balancing act with this, is how, as you're looking at this from the standpoint of being a trustee for the Common School Fund, how do you make sure that you're not, you know, weighing it too much in either way, that either you're not distributing it enough today so that the kids today aren't disadvantaged versus adversely affecting the kids in the future. But it is a tough one.
Let me call on Representative Whitwell and make my swift departure. I'll be back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't that exactly the kind of policy considerations the legislature should be making?
Representative Witt, I think that is, yes, there is one that the legislature should be making, and I think also it's one that the trustees of the Common School Fund, the land board, have been wrestling with. In the last 2 years ago, they developed a new distribution formula based on looking at the earnings of the Common School Fund and what should be at a minimum distributed and at a maximum distributed. So they were trying to wrestle exactly with that issue. But, you know, it is a policy discussion as well as a legal one, too.
But surely the legislature has a responsibility under the Constitution to make sure that Oregon schools are adequately funded. Isn't that true?
Representative Witt, yes, that is true.
Okay. If you looked at the Common School Fund today, and I understand it's somewhere around $800 million, isn't it true that the overwhelming amount of that money has come from earnings into the fund that were reinvested into the fund? Not the value of the land that was given in 1859, but the earnings over time that have been reinvested into the fund.
Representative, yes, that is true, especially in the last 10 years. I mentioned to you the statutory constitutional investment sources, that the constitutional sources generated $40 million investment earnings, were twice that amount.
Okay, and isn't it true that constitutionally, the legislature had the authority, without violating federal law, from using earnings from that land and make it available for K-12 education?
Yes, and although where it begins to be difficult to start to look at is on that concept of a long-term trust and looking at how much can you distribute and spend today versus over the long term.
That's a legal issue now you're getting to. I'm asking about the policy consideration. Mm-hmm. Didn't the legislature always have the discretion to take earnings from that fund and make it available for K-12 education? Not the corpus, not the value of the land as it was donated in 1859, earnings from the land.
If I may, Representative Witt, the Constitution has always had a provision in it about how much can be expended, at least the version as it was amended in 1968. So I'm not sure that there's always been some limitation on the money that comes out of the Common School Fund.
Okay. Let's go back to 1990 when the fund was, what, $100 million?
About 200 million or so.
Okay, now it's 800 million. So we've got a $600 million roughly increase in appreciation. Isn't it true? Now, this came from earnings that were reinvested into the fund. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, earnings reinvested as well as new revenues coming in.
All right. Did the legislature not have the authority throughout the last 10 or 12 years to take earnings from the fund and use it for K-12 funding if it chose to?
Constitutionally, I believe that's the authority of the land board to determine how that revenue should be distributed.
Fine. The land board, did it have the constitutional authority to do that? To allocate earnings from the fund?
It could allocate earnings, and it does that in terms of distribution to the schools. Are you saying...
I'm asking if the authority existed to use that money for K-12 expenses during the last 10 years as those earnings were generated.
The land board can determine the distribution of those earnings, yes.
Okay. So should one conclude that we cheated the kids in the 90s because we didn't give the full benefit of the earnings into K-12 education and we're overly benefiting children in the future?
I think that was, as I understand, that was one of the reasons why the land board changed their policy in terms of the distribution 2 years ago, because it recognized that it was the other way around, that it was not benefiting kids today as much as future kids. And so it changed its distribution formula to have a floor of earnings go out in terms of a minimum of 2%, and then it ratcheted up depending on the earnings.
Okay, so again, my question is should one conclude that throughout the 90s that we have we've been unfair to kids who were in schools in the 90s because we gave very little of these earnings and put it into K-12 education, because we've been building up this large corpus, which is now over $800 million, and thus we have unfairly benefited future generations at the expense of the current generation?
I think probably in the early 90s, when the decision was made by the land board to try to grow the fund as quickly as possible, then I would say that probably it was done, yeah, at the expense of the current kids.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason I raised that question, Ann, is, I mean, it's exactly the flip side of what you're saying. You're saying if we use earnings from this fund and we use what is part of the corpus, which came about from earnings in times of a downturn, you raised the question, are we cheating kids in the future? I'd make exactly the opposite argument, that we've been unfair to kids in the present, and over the last 10 or 12 years, by not using more of these earnings that we could have used to fund K-12 education. Instead, we've built up this enormous fund. A couple other questions, and then I'll stop for now. Under trust law, isn't it the general rule of trust law that it grants authority to the trustee for the benefit of the beneficiary so long as it is not contrary to the expressions of the settlor? Isn't that the general rule of trust law?
Sounds correct.
Kevin Chuba.
All right, so what's inappropriate here about HJR 64 in that these funds were granted to the state of Oregon? The state of Oregon is the trustee of these funds. And the beneficiary is students, past, now, and in the future. What is inappropriate under trust law for the trustee, a.k.a. the state of Oregon through the legislature, to make a decision relative to the dispersing these funds in times of economic downturn to benefit current students? Where's the trust law problem? It's very consistent with trust law.
Representative, with the courts that have examined the question of the Common School Fund have not made any distinction between the Admissions Act lands and the other sources of income inside the fund. It's potential that there isn't necessarily a distinction between them, that it is an irreducible fund. And the question of proceeds and whether or not proceeds become part of that trust corpus over time is a question I don't think I can answer here, but I sense that that's the nub of what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, it seems to me the proceeds were for earnings that certainly for the last 20 or 30 years have been subject to disposition by the state in terms of what they wanted, what the state wanted to do with those earnings relative, as long as it was going to the benefit of K-12 public education. So, you know, and the state as trustee has that authority. And then finally, if not the Common School Fund, please tell me where we get a stabilization fund. It's great to say it should come from lottery dollars, it should come from tobacco revenue, it should come from the general fund, it should come from who knows where. But tell me where this legislature or the next legislature or the next legislature is going to create a school stabilization fund, if not the Common School Fund. Tell me where it's going to come from. So I haven't seen it happen.
I think if you, there's been a proposal by the governor in terms of using some lottery monies. I think it'd be worth looking at other states and how they've set up their stabilization funds. It's not an easy thing to do. It's like trying to save for the future on a personal standpoint of trying to put aside money. It's not an easy thing to try.
Well, yeah, I would suggest it's not going to happen. Okay, it's not going to happen. I mean, this has been talked about and talked about and talked about. We have a vehicle with $800 million in it. We have the constitutional right to use that money as a stabilization fund. And in the Dash 3s, it even requires us to pay it back. So I'm having trouble here with the arguments that we're cheating future generations for current generations. I think it's just the opposite. We've been cheating current and recently passed students for the benefit of future generations. And I think the legislature has a constitutional responsibility here to make sure that K-12 education is adequately funded, and it needs to use the vehicles that are available to it constitutionally to do that.
I think that, you know, even though, you know, there may have been policies with regard to the Common School Fund and how it's been used in the past, and it has had a long history in terms of its ups and downs and how the Common School Fund has been applied, but I think it's worth looking at how do we want to use this Common School Fund, you know, from here on, and, you know, what is the best way of doing it? Is it best to be able to take monies that have taken 140 years to accumulate and use that for one economic downturn when, in fact, it can benefit kids for a long time to come?
With the requirement that we have to pay it back?
But the requirement...
I mean, the point is it's here to benefit kids now, mm-hmm. now and in the future. And in view of the fact there's no other vehicle in place, and I don't see the legislature about to adopt another vehicle, I think it'd be absolutely, if the legislature is given this constitutional authority, I think it would be absolutely irresponsible for the legislature in times of an economic downturn, which this resolution requires, be absolutely irresponsible for the legislature not make sure that kids today get the education they deserve.
But I think you'd also have to look to make sure that even though it would have to be repaid, you know, are you truly repaying the Common School Fund if you're not paying it back with interest, and what is the impact then over time where it would have lower earnings or lower distributions in the future?
How is that any different, Ann, than the fact that we've taken earnings over the last 20, 30 years and we've just added it to the fund instead of using it for K-12 education? I don't see how that's any different. I mean, the principle is we should come to a funding level that we can come to meet the needs of kids in schools today. And this bill, I think, is a very responsible way to do it. Anyhow, I've taken enough time, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hass?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I honestly believe that Ann is onto something when she says we're benefiting today's kids at the expense of future kids through the Common School Fund. And Representative Witt, it's precisely because of what you touched upon that I'm starting to pause here, because if we do this, that means that we will be avoiding the very hard political decision that you mentioned, such as how to fund a stabilization fund, finding the lottery money, the tobacco money, or just making an appropriation to start a stabilization fund so that we don't have to mess with the Common School Fund and so that we can do the right thing. And that involves a tough decision to get that seed money to begin with. So I guess that was more of a comment.
Madam Chair.
President Bates.
I had a couple of questions, if I could, Madam Chair. We've gone through an unprecedented 10 years of economic expansion, which this country has never seen before, which in large degree is probably the reason this program has grown so much, I would assume. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you find it prudent policy that during the times, the good times, that we put away money and that we don't spend it all as we go along?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Bates, yes. I think that's a sound principle.
And during this 10 years, did you feel that the use of the common school fund was not to be saving money for rainy day, but to build the fund up for future students?
Representative Bates, that was the idea was to try to, as I understand it, early in the 90s, was to try to build up the common school fund so that it would become a good source of revenue for the schools.
This also occurred during a time of ballot measure 5 coming on the books when the cost of schooling was going to be shifted from the local level to the state level. Was that a part of that decision-making process?
I don't know. I started in this position in October, so I'm not sure.
In previous downturns of the economy, how did schools get funded? They didn't go to the common school fund to do it, so how did that occur, do you know?
It was funded... I'm not an expert on school finance, but as I understand, it was funded through a combination of property taxes and general fund.
I'm wondering...
I'm wondering
if in previous downturns, did they raise a surtax? I mean, the revenues, income tax, of course, most of it was state, was local tax at that point. Only about 30% was state taxes.
Representative Bates, maybe Paul.
Yeah. Paul?
That would be...
Well, I think, if you look at the last recession, 1991 was the same time Measure 5 was coming in.
I know. That's
so that dominated the school finance discussion at that time. And revenues, even though they slowed down considerably, stayed within the range of the forecast. So you have to go back to the early 80s. And as you say, at that point, 30% of school funding was coming from the state. Now, of course, we also had a series of problems throughout the state with schools. Remember the safety net legislation that followed in the 80s? That was in the response to areas that were hit hard economically that wouldn't pass levies. So there were clearly some consequences, but more on the property tax side than on the state side. And, of course, at the state level, you had a series of tax increase measures, including surcharges on corporate and personal income, a decision to disconnect from the federal tax code.
Yeah, I think there was a surtax that was added in the early 80s.
There was a
temporary
surtax. On both personal and corporate, yeah.
How that I recall.
I believe that was probably the case, too. I vaguely remember that. The point I'm trying to get to is this. I think both parties here have some truth to what they're saying. We have a radically different way of funding our schools now than we did even 10 years ago. Eagle Point School District I'm in 1977, closed their schools for almost 4 months in the middle of the year. Those kids were sent home, K through 12. That started a change, and then ballot measure 5 completed the change. The state is now basically responsible for funding schools. The ratio is completely flipped to 70-80% now from the general fund of the state we collect. And the need for a rainy day fund is clear. This fund hopefully has grown, or hopefully did grow quickly, to a large amount of money that could be tapped for a rainy day fund, which was not its original purpose. I understand that. My personal feeling is, and I don't know if you'd agree with this or not, if this provision was that money could be tapped for a rainy day fund, but that the fund had to be made whole, this is any family savings had to be made whole after a crisis has passed, would you still oppose this bill? If you knew you're getting your principal back, and it would be not impossible to figure out the interest or growth that would have occurred because some of the money would still be there for the time that was taken out, would you still oppose this bill if you knew that after the crisis was over, that the legislature would make the fund whole again? By meaning whole, there would be no loss in earnings during that time. Mm-hmm. It would be principal and interest both, or principal and growth, whichever you want to call it.
I think that would help to make it, that would improve it. I think there still would be concerns about, what would you do with distributions in the interim? Would you still continue to make distributions in the interim, or would you suspend those? What this would mean to the investment strategy for the common school fund? Would you make that whole with the remaining balance that would be there? And what kind of interest rate would you give in terms of repaying it? I think that would be something that we would have to look into to see if whether or not that would be okay. But I think there could still be some concerns connected with
Madam
that.
Madam Chair, obviously, if you're going into the principal, you'd be bringing more money out of funds than the distribution would normally do. If you're putting out 70 or 80 million in distributions as an example, but you're in a really terrible situation, you need an extra 100 million, obviously you could do both at the same time, knowing you had to pay it back, though, and that it had to be paid back with, along with any losses. I'm still not sure why you would oppose a bill that says we're going to have an extra job for this fund to do. It's going to be our rainy day fund. We will make you whole within 6 years, and it'll help the kids now, and it won't hurt the kids in the future. I'm not sure what policy we're not fulfilling by doing that.
I think the policy questions would be, would you be able to make it whole, and and to make sure that is there a way to determine that, and also whether or not whether or not you'd still have legal risk connected with that. And that's something, I don't know, Kevin, would you have a response to that?
Madam Chair, obviously in the safe situation, we did make them whole to the tune of doubling the money we paid back, but I can't answer the legal risk because I'm not a lawyer. I wouldn't know. I think
yeah, and that's where I'm sorry I'm not being able to give you a clear yes or no, because it does get entangled in some legal issues in trying to figure out what it would take to make that whole. And then there's a policy question of, is that going to be a very expensive loan by, from
my,
the general
my question
fund?
Was the policy, not the legal aspect. So I can't answer that. I can't even answer the question.
We do have representatives. We have Greg Chiam to come up after we're done with this if you have legal questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just have a couple more questions. I'm not being an expert on the school funding formula yet, we'll get to that a little later, and the constitutional provisions. What Representative Bates is asking about, doesn't the legislature include those distributions within its school funding formula discussion? So don't they look at the property taxes coming in, the general fund that's available, your distributions, other federal funds, and so on, and that creates the formula? So I guess I'm having a difficult time understanding why you're thinking of these distributions outside of that whole discussion that the legislature actually goes through anyway.
The formula itself is based on the actual fund growth from year to year.
I'm talking about the school funding formula, K-12,
okay.
The entire formula. Yours is just one tiny
Ours
piece.
Ours is just one piece, correct.
But it is encompassed within that broader school funding formula. So if you were to take, as Representative Bates was saying, a part of the school common school fund to add to that, distributions would just be—they'd be considered as part of that. They're not in—they're not outside and above what we figure out in terms of the totality, anyway. Isn't that true?
Paul, can you answer the question in terms of how that whole formula works? Because I don't know the ins and outs of that as well.
Representative Crossman, Madam Chair, the common school fund distributions are determined by the land board annually, and they are considered local revenue. So they are go through Steve's runs as part of the state school fund distribution. So
we have to offset what we come up with a number, and the local revenue is offset with what the state has to do, and that's all part of it.
Right. Even though we think of them as statewide, they are considered local revenues for purposes of the formula, but they're rolled into the property tax collections and other local revenue sources to make up that local total.
Mm-hmm.
We will, by the way, be updating you on local resource or estimates on Friday. Steve will update you on that, and it does include a lower assumption about the common school fund because of the weakness in the equity market. So there is an annual distribution coming from the common school fund that is rolled into the formula as part of the state school budget.
And one other question. Does this part of your budget go through the Ways and Means process, or are you reporting to them on a biannual basis about how much is in the common school fund and the decision-making process that you're using to actually figure out how you allocate those distributions and so on? Or is that independent of legislative oversight?
Vice Chair Kefouri, Representative Carlson, yes, it's part of the discussion of our budget. However, it is a non-limited amount, and it's determined by the formula that the land board sets. So the land board basically has oversight and determines what that formula is. It's not set through the budgetary process, if that's what your question is.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you. Lorna Walker.
If you'll forgive me, I have very little voice today. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
My name is Lorna Walker. I'm here as an interested citizen in relation to HJR 64. Primarily, the information I've given to you is a matter of identification and specifically for the point of raising some questions. Some of my questions have been well addressed by former speakers, for which I'm most appreciative. In considering this, I would like for us to think about the fact that when funds are established as dedicated funds, we have quite a responsibility to consider the cost involved in the initial establishing of this process. Oftentimes, it comes out of times of very serious need and a great deal of sacrifice. Now, if we look at it and say that the cost is very great to those who are involved in the early part of that sacrifice, then we have to really consider that when that sacrifice is made, we're kind of putting a double whammy on those people. If we turn around and either choose to close that fund or borrow from the fund and not repay it in an equitable fashion. Now, there have been some suggestions of ways of repaying borrowing from the fund that would include the principal and perhaps the interest. I think we have to also consider that if the question is how the fund is being managed. We need to examine exactly that, the management of the fund. In the reading of the bill, that did not appear to initially be the issue. There's great value in having a stabilization or a rainy day fund, and the sheer process of doing that is to establish a fund, decide what sources that's going to come from, whether it's from lottery funds or from whatever source, and apportion it out for a certain number of years, that nothing be taken out for a certain number of years until there is sufficient principal built up to do something with it. But if we are looking at this fund in terms of what can be done in terms of our state portfolio of investments. That was not clear to me. One of the questions I have is whether this was being examined in order to take what is currently a set of dedicated funds and use it as a part of a state portfolio of undedicated funds, or whether the intent was to leave it as dedicated funds. Now, my understanding from what I've heard today is that the intent is to retain this as the dedicated fund that it currently is. The thing that I think that we have to consider is that those who are managing the funds need to be able to plan both their investment strategies over a long term and know what they're working with over a long term. And as I believe was indicated, that there is a distribution that is included into the school formula that has to be accounted for in some fashion. The other thing that I feel that needs to be considered in relation to this is that, pardon me for a moment. The other thing that I feel that needs to be considered in relation to this is that we look very carefully at how we use our funds, and that we are not minimizing our returns. The investment interest cycles over a period of time might be greatly hampered by borrowing from the fund. It might severely interfere with a natural growth that would give a long-term, return on this. Do you have any questions?
Are there questions for Ms. Walker? Okay, thank you for
Thank you. I have appreciated the people who have done their work on this. As I said, I believe there's real value in having a stabilization or a rainy day fund. I think there's a great need for that. But I would not recommend lightly borrowing from the principal. My feeling is the principal should remain intact unless there's a very sure way of repaying that principal and the demonstrated accrued interest.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Does anybody else wish to testify before I ask Mr. Chamov to come back? Okay, great. Oh! Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to testify, but having heard
I was so inspired.
Gene Thorne from the Governor's Office. Just like to respond to some of the questions are raised earlier, and I think the Governor, as a member of the Land Board, we had a brief discussion this morning, and he certainly would be willing to look at, as a member of the Land Board, to look at some portion of future earnings going into a stabilization fund. I would like to note again, just remind you, it's been about 3 or 4 months since I was here to talk about a proposal he has put forward, HJR 5, which never was actually heard by this committee, but House Bill 2299 is a school stability fund. And one of the questions was, what are some other sources? In HJR 5, this proposal has been that the Education Endowment Fund, which is 15% of lottery revenues, that assuming a November 2002 election, that beginning July 1st of 2003, that the endowment fund, the 15% of lottery proceeds would go into school stabilization fund. Now that it doesn't get you there quickly, but it would get you about $90 to $100 million per biennium. It would leave the principal in the endowment fund so you could continue using those interest earnings as they are now for a debt service on lottery-backed bonds and also expanded need grant program. In addition, 2299 included lottery revenues over $600 million a biennium, and we're just about up to there now. Frankly, that's part of his concern about on the lottery policy is becoming more dependent over time on lottery revenues if, in the event, line games or some other type of game should increase lottery revenues. If you had that kind of cap, at least then those additional revenues would go into a stability fund. So I would encourage you to think about perhaps a combination of looking at some future common school fund revenues, look at the endowment fund, look at, quote, excess lottery revenues as perhaps one other way to address the concern of how to fund a stability fund.
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it true that the 15% of lottery revenues that is going to education is being used now every biennium to go into the funds that get spread through the formula, so it's being used for current operating expenses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wett, the earnings are used. So I think it's, I don't have it right in front of me, about $11 million, I think, this next biennium is going to pay for the debt service, or going towards, it doesn't pay completely, the debt service on lottery-backed bonds. So if you continued, we have, I think at the end of this biennium, about $191 million principal, and by the end of next biennium, I think $280-something, $290 projected. if you still held on to that, you'd still have the interest earnings that could continue paying what they're paying now, but the principal does not go through the distribution.
We actually talked about that, Mr. Chairman, in our discussions, Paul, and what was the concern we had with that? You're talking about using that in addition to the common school funds that would be available.
I think the issue was just the current size of the endowment fund right now. It hasn't been around for a long time, so they've had two biennial collections, so there's not a lot of existing revenue right now. And again, if you think about a 4-5% hit from a common or typical recession, that would be exhausted pretty quickly. So that was, as I recall, that was the issue, was just the size of it at this point.
Now, is there any, constitutionally, in terms of the purpose for these funds, Paul, the Common School Fund and then the 15% that goes into the education fund from the lottery, is there any significant difference in terms of the constitutional purpose of these funds?
I would have to look back on the precise language of the Education Endowment Fund. Jean, do you know offhand?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
And they're both, as I understand it, both dedicated to K-12 education funding, aren't they?
Correct.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, the reason we focus on the Common School Fund, because it was 4 or 5 times the size in terms of the available fund. When there was some reason we looked at not doing both, and it's just not coming to me right now.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, briefly what I'd like to do is simply set the legal parameters for you for this measure. The Common School Fund is a trust fund that the people created. As the creators of that fund, the people, through an amendment of their constitution, are to a great extent free to change the nature of that trust. They may not change the nature of the trust when there is an overriding legal obligation, as was imposed by the Admissions Act, as a result of accepting admission to the United States. Oregon may not dip into the principle of the Admissions Act lands. Another exception to the general rule that the people may change a trust they create is where the people have, in some form of a promise or an agreement, suggested that they would not dip into that trust, and that, in our view, would be in the case of bequests that people would have made at the time when they would reasonably have had the understanding that the funds and the bequest would be used in perpetuity for school purposes. Except for those two circumstances, it's our best advice to you that the people do have the authority to change the nature of the trust and adopt the amendment proposed by HJR 64.
I can add one thing to Mr. Chair. To me, the issue in terms of the amount of the fund available revolves around the proceeds, as Greg has described it. Those proceeds from sale of those lands, and about 3/4 of the lands from the Admissions Act have been sold. So the issue is, how do you define proceeds? If you define proceeds as the cash payment that was made at the time the land was sold, most of it made over 100 years ago, then that's probably a pretty small amount.
Mr. Chair, to address Mr. Warder's issue, the Constitution makes a difference. It uses different terminology for proceeds and revenue. In our view, proceeds means receipt of sale of land. It does not mean the earnings. Earnings are revenue.
Okay. That was my question, because I see proceeds as being two things, potentially, one being the consideration for the grant of the conveyance of the property, that being the proceeds, but then proceeds being also earnings. But you're saying that under the Constitution that's revenue and not proceeds.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
So based upon that, I mean, it's highly likely that the overwhelming percentage of the fund as it's currently constituted would, if HJR 64 came into the Constitution, would be available for the legislature without running afoul of the Admissions Act.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, you'd have to address that question to someone who understands numbers.
I'll ask Paul that.
Well, I guess also a matter of segregating out and going back into historical documents and segregating out the accounts in the treasurer's office and the common school fund, but I would hope that there'd be a way of doing that. She smiled. We'll take that as a yes. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Greg? Well, I apologize for having missed a good bit of the discussion here. I guess in what I heard at the very end, though, it seems to me that the advantage of House Resolution 64 over what I have heard in the way of other stabilization fund efforts is the fact that we have a substantial principal amount there that's available to us when this is enacted. And the concern I have about either an unfunded stabilization fund, such as HJR 33 or whatever that was we passed last week, or even looking at the education endowment, is that it's going to take time to build those principal fund balances up to a point where they're going to really represent any substantial benefit for the, as a stabilization fund. So I don't know if that's responsive to the discussion that we heard, but that's sure my thinking on the direction we're going with HJR 64.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
Yeah, I mean, I'd make the point that this is a true stabilization fund. It's not something that some legislature 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now might fund, but it's a full of money that should HJR 64 become law, that at least gives future legislatures the opportunity to do what that legislature thinks is necessary to make sure that our schools aren't funded inadequately, given an economic downturn. And unlike HJR 33, this has specific economic criteria, and only based on those criteria can this fund be tapped. And then with the dash threes, the requirement that it be paid back within three biennia. The issue of interest was raised over the last year. The funds lost money. Does that mean if we had borrowed some money last biennium that we should have to pay, we should get some additional back because we kept them from losing money? I mean, there's no clear way of determining what they would have made from those investments. And I think, Mr. Chairman, I think you made the point properly that if the family's hungry, you might tap into the college education fund. You know, you take care of basic requirements first, and then constitutionally, under the dash threes, the legislature has the responsibility to pay that back. Constitutionally, it has to.
And I think, too, clearly this is not the enabling legislation. This authorizes the legislature to go about this. And with respect to the legal arguments raised by Division of State Lands and Department of Justice, understanding that there are questions that have to be answered and how we address that, I think that's an issue for the enabling legislation. This resolution itself doesn't appropriate any money. And I don't think this appropriation itself in any way violates the Admissions Act or any trust. It would be more a matter of how the legislature, after this authorization, would go about drawing on the funds in the Common School Fund. So that's really a matter to be looked at. And there will be time to look at how we do that without running afoul of either the Constitution or the Admissions Act. Any other comments? I think we're still in public hearing. I'm inclined to go to work session and see where we go. Does Representative Bates?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I agree the bill, or the resolution, I should say, is in a concept. I still have a problem with making the fund whole after you've taken the money out. If money has been lost during the time that you took the money out, obviously you wouldn't have to be forced to replace something that never occurred, and I think that could be determined. However, having said that, I'd still support the bill, but I would be feeling much better about it if it made the fund whole at the end of the 6 years. But I understand Representative Witt's position here.
And
I support the bill basically as a good way to use a fund that's available to us in a much better way that's being used now. The amount of money we get from this is $70 or $80 million in a $5.2 billion budget. It's a drop in the bucket. This makes this fund actually a lot more important to us, if it can be used as a rainy day fund at times of economic downturn, as long as we hold ourselves responsible to pay it back. And I support that part of the bill.
And I appreciate the comments. On the issue of the payback, I originally had asked Representative Witt to look at an amendment to put the money back plus foregone earnings. But I think mechanically that becomes very difficult when you're taking money out of different funds to approximate or to achieve what those earnings might have been
And certainly the legislature can, you know, can put back more or something approximately, but I think in the Constitution, that'd be a tough target to hit, to say that you're going to put back the foregone earnings. It also doesn't raise, I suppose, the possibility of Representative Witt that if the earnings have gone down, then the fund could get less than it was taken, than was taken out. Representative Beck?
Well, I just wanted to say I'm probably not going to support the bill. I thought it was a good idea when it came up, and I'm just happy to co-sponsor it with other members of the committee. I'm just wary of referrals in general, and I'm particularly wary of referrals where we're not hearing a clamor from the public. We've had a lot of detailed public testimony commenting on people's various concerns with it, but I always get worried about who's going to go out and campaign for these things. And we also, since this measure was brought forward, we have passed a stabilization fund on the floor. I voted against it, actually, for some of the same reasons, but I do believe that approach, forcing the legislature to make some tough budgeting decisions, and I think that bill may get amended in the Senate to try to put some money into it, as I've been told by some of the sponsors. But that measure does have a constituency that's ready to go out and fight on the campaign trail for it. And I would hate to see these two measures on the ballot confusing people. I think if we're going to do a stabilization fund, it ought to be done more comprehensively. Maybe there should be some other stabilization mechanisms put into this measure, add, you know, as many tools as we can all at once rather than doing it sort of piecemeal. And we're using the Constitution, that's when we should be as broad and inclusive as possible. And I think this is a right idea for addition to the BAT, any work group over the session, over the interim, and but I'm just not, I don't feel that this has gelled sufficiently to warrant sending it to the floor and through the process in this building.
In response to that, let me just suggest that I think you're right. We should not send out 33 and 64 to go side by side on the ballot. I think, though, that it is worth sending 64, my personal feeling, across the floor of the House and to the Senate, to have it considered with 33 and your proposal to merge some of the concepts into one,
right,
or to evaluate them and select this as perhaps superior to 33, whatever. Right. I think it's worth putting this over there to be considered in light of 33 and let the Senate make a recommendation back for us to concur or not concur. And I want to make sure this is still in the mix of things being considered out there. And this is a good way to do it. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and open a work session on HJR 64. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill to HJR 64.
Representative Witt moves the Dash 2 amendments to HJR 64. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? There is.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 3 amendments.
The Dash 3 amendments to HJR 64. Is there discussion on that motion? This is the payback amendment. Any objection? They are in.
Mr. Chairman, I move HJR 64 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves HJR 64 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Representative Beck, do you want to say any more before we...
No, I have them. Just going to gently vote no.
Gently vote no. Those are the best kind. Anybody else? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative A.
Aye.
F.
No.
Brown.
Aye.
F.
Oh.
Williams.
Aye.
Rhea.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Kefauri?
Aye.
Chair Shatterly?
Votes aye. House Joint Resolution 64 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Hess? What? You're not volunteering to carry.
I just want to say I very much respect Representative Witt brainstorming this out of nowhere to deal with this issue.
Thank you. So do I. I think this is one kind of born of another one of our brilliant ideas here in committee that I'm glad Representative Witt went down to LC and got drafted. We've had some doozies. Representative Witt, do you want to carry this?
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
All right. CR 64 is on its way. Let me see then. 3619. Who's here on 3619? Okay.
To read sometimes.
Oh, I've got the sign up. Let me open a public hearing briefly on 3619. Okay. Jim Green and John Pendergrass.
Might you want to combine it with.
Steve, do you want to. It's been a couple of weeks anyway since I've heard this. Tell us about it one more time.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 3619, as amended, makes the Department of Education responsible for providing education to students that are in juvenile detention. What it does is to give those students a 1.5 times weight and sets aside money from the state school fund for the Department of Education to use to provide those education programs. It limits the number of students that can be funded to 350 per year. And then since the state takes over that responsibility of providing their education, if there's any change from the district or DSD providing those services, the teachers that are currently involved would have to be employed by the new provider, being the state, as long as it was cost effective to do that. So that would provide about $7,400 per juvenile detention student, and that would take money out of the state school fund set aside for that purpose, about $2.59 million at the full funding level for 350. And then what would happen that the school districts then would not receive those funds out of the state school fund, but then they would no longer have the cost of providing the education in the juvenile detention facilities.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'll be brief. This was a vehicle that was created through a work group of folks that included the Department of Education, juvenile county detention facility managers, school districts, ESDs, to try to address the issue of students in a juvenile detention facility. Several sessions ago, the legislature dealt with how we provide education services to the Oregon Youth Authority students in full-time lockdown facilities. The way this process works currently is the resident district where the student's parent or person in a parental relationship resides receives a bill from the school district where these facilities are located. That student may have dropped out, may not ever have attended school there, but that school district gets this bill from the school district where these facilities are located, and that school district has to pay that bill. And if they haven't claimed that student in the state school fund, it does take time for the state school fund dollars to get to that school district, but they have to pay that bill when they receive it. An instance that I can recall, the Santiam Canyon School District received a bill from the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD because they provide the services to the Albany Juvenile Detention Facility, and the superintendent called me and said, Jim, I have this bill for about $8,000. I don't never had these kids in my school district, but their parents happen to reside here now. What do I need to do? I called Mr. Pendergrass at the Department of Ed and found out he needed to pay that bill. But this vehicle was created through a work group that provides the education program, transfers responsibility to the Department of Education, makes sure that funds are available when the student shows up at the juvenile detention facility. It really, truly doesn't cost the state school fund any money. It just shifts the money, as Mr. Meyer explained, from the school districts where it's currently at to a fund that the Department of Education has in order to pay for the cost of this program.
Okay. Mr. Pendergrass, did you want to say anything else?
Representative Shirley, members of the committee, Representative Hobson, I would just like to say that the department is supportive of this bill, that it gets rid of this bill-back procedure that has been so troublesome for at least a dozen years that I know of. Also, we feel as though the granting of rulemaking authority to the state board is a positive thing. Right now, there's no standards for these programs, so the department supports Bill HB 3619 as amended.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gardner, why don't you come on forward? Jim, if you could stay there for a second. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, State Representative from House District 13. I simply here in support of House Bill 3619. I feel that all forms of education are vital knowledge, provide vital knowledge and vocational and technical skills training for students, that education enables students to think critically, enhance communication skills, and provides young men and women with the necessary skills to succeed in a career and to be productive members of society. But youth in a juvenile detention facility were consistently forgotten by Oregon's education funding formula. Juvenile detention education programs must be able to meet the needs of youth from the time that they enter the facility until the time they leave, and current funding levels don't allow that to happen. I just feel that once you have an individual in one of these facilities, you should make the most available use of the time to see that they're fully educated as much as possible, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Representative Gardner? Thank you for joining us.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative
I don't have a question for Representative Gardner. I'm not sure who could answer this, but I was just looking at the staff measure summary that came out of the Student Achievement and School Accountability, and it says potential for additional federal funds. Where would that come from? What potentially?
Yes, Representative Shetterly, Representative Carlson. We feel that in the second year of this funding arrangement, based on a first-year census, we can probably generate some Title I neglected and delinquent funds that are not currently going to these programs. There is interest in using those dollars to extend the school year. Currently, about two-thirds, about 60% of the kids have a year-round 220-day education program, and about 40% have a about 190-day education program. So that testimony related to the possibility of extending the school year so that we wouldn't have kids locked up without an education program in that remaining 40% that don't have a summer program.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for any of these witnesses? Okay, thanks very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3619 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson. Was it before you? Okay, sorry.
It's okay. People often get us.
Oh, yeah,
different
right.
Hair, though. No,
that's okay. So I'm not confused anymore. I move House Bill 3619A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Before he moves House Bill 3619A to the floor with the due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Fay.
Aye.
Staff.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Powell.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Tesori.
Aye.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. House Bill 3619 goes to the floor of the due pass. Is there a carrier? Representative Bates, you can have it.
Thank you.
Chair requests unanimous consent that we suspend the rules and temporarily return to work session on Senate Bill 521 to allow Representative Kafori to cast a vote on the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none. We're in work session on 521. Representative Kafori, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Close that work session. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that we return temporarily to work session on Senate Bill 520 for the purpose of allowing Representative Kafori to cast a vote on the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none. We're in work session. Representative Kafori, how do you vote?
Aye.
Votes aye. Close the work session. We're adjourned. Good job today, everyone.
Yeah, yeah.